E-commerce isn't just an aspect of growing a successful wine business, it is crucial. And that's why I strongly recommend working with Offset Partners. As a proudly independent e-commerce technology and brand design company based in wine country, Offset understands the operational nuances and the customer service imperatives that distinguish a great online buying experience from a mediocre one. And that's why leading and legendary brands like Saxum, Arnott Roberts, and Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant choose Offset's proprietary commerce technology platform to power their DTC sales. If you're an allocated winery or a high-touch merchant that values an elegant, effective commerce solution for both you, your customers, and your team, reach out to the smart team at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET, partners with an S.com, to craft a better direct-to-consumer experience.
I'm Levy Dalton, and this is All Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the wine business.
So we're here today with Mike Madrigal. Mr. Magic.
How are you?
Mike, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure, buddy. Thanks for having me.
Here we are at the Cellar Blue Sud, your home, your place, your reign, your territory.
Yeah.
And I thought we'd do what you do best, which is talk about some wine. Hope that's okay.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. You know, I pulled two bottles of wines that, you know, I love to smell, I love to taste. They really have a lot of complexity to them, and they're easy to talk about. So the first one I have is... it's an Alsatian Riesling.
Okay.
Weinbach, who, you know, I was in Alsace in October, and it was the first time I really figured out what they have there. And, you know, when people talk about Riesling, they talk about Germany and they talk about Austria, but Alsace seems to be...
kind of in between. It's like almost
on
neither pole, so it's sort of forgotten about some way.
Right. But, you know, in this country... you have a guy like Terry Thies, you know, and he's really shaped...
an advocate.
Right, of Austria and Germany.
And so many people listen to that voice.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
But Terry loves Alsace.
Right.
I mean, he goes to Boxler every year.
For sure. But, I mean, he doesn't import it.
He doesn't bring it in. He
right.
doesn't and, champion it.
Right. And no one's championing the wines. And, you know, it's almost like you forget about it because
right.
it's not in your face all the time. And when I went there, I was like, what is going on that
right.
nobody is talking about these
and
wines?
And also great cuisine, like a history of great restaurants.
Yeah. yeah.
And a lot of chefs that we think of as great French chefs are from that region. John George, you know, worked there for a long time.
Well, you know, it's funny. The wines are so good with food.
Is that true? Yeah.
Well, I think so. Because
it's like one of those situations where they grew up together.
Right. And, you know, most of the time they're dry. So the palate of food pairing is... you know, exponential. It's
you do
it
find
doesn't
them
end.
Most of the time to be dry.
Well, the ones that I find that they're more often dry than German wines, for sure. Are they more often dry than Austrian wines? I don't know. But so
I feel like in the 80s when they first kind of took steam and people were talking about them, when you read about them in books, they would be dry. People would say, this is dry.
Right.
But then people started dealing with more ripeness and low yields. And then there was a question of whether it was going to be dry, and you didn't know. And so then people like Zind had to add the Indies number. And
I
feel like sometimes you don't know whether it's going to be dry before you open it.
Well, I think that was that period was a period because of wine writers influencing, you know, what they liked, and a lot of growers changing their style in order to sell the wines more.
But it also, like,
frankly,
that was the beginning of global warming. Like, that was the first time we saw warm years where residual might, they just didn't know what to do with it. It was like, what are we going to do? Is we going to leave this in? Are we going to ferment it out? Is
yeah.
it going to be super high alcohol? And then sometimes you'd get like a Vendange Tardive and it would be somewhat dry.
Yeah.
Like it's late picked.
Still like that now.
But you wouldn't know if it would be sweet or not.
Like right.
Some of the terminology is a little vague. Like if you get a late picked wine somewhere else, you're pretty much sure that that's going to be sweet.
But. Right on, right on. And they're working towards that. They're definitely working towards some sort of scale on the back of the bottle, where a sliding scale that tells you how dry it is or how sweet it is from 1 to 10.
I feel like they give you some and they take some away. It's like, okay, we're going to give you the right to vote, but you can no longer have sex with underage women. Like we're going to give you something and take it away, because it's like they give you...
What do you mean?
The grape variety. They give you
right.
grape variety.
Right.
But they don't give you always vineyard. You know, sometimes people suppress whether it's a Grand Cru or not.
and they.
But
don't
that's
always.
The old school guys, because they don't believe in.
But
the
they're
system.
Huge producers, and they and they don't give you whether it's sweet or not. So it's like some of the fundamentals are there, which might not be there in other parts of France, but then some of the other fundamentals aren't. It's somewhat difficult.
Yeah, I mean, there's no easy answer. You know, especially with this wine. Global marketplace, for right. sure. You know, there is no easy answer, and they're working towards it, which, you know, they're trying. And I'm okay with that.
Oh, but, yeah, no doubt. I mean, yeah. I'm certainly okay with it. I wonder, in terms of broad outreach, whether it might be easier to sell if some of the information were there.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, sometimes you look at a German wine label, you're like, almost too much information.
For sure. And at the same time, you know, this discovery of Alsatian wine that I had was my own personally. You know, it's the fact that it isn't everywhere and sure. not a lot of people are talking about it. Sure. It makes it more personal.
So tell us a little bit about that. You went on a trip. I mean, what
went
was
on
like?
A trip. And it was great. It was organized by Paul Greco.
He's always been such a fan. I mean, I remember being at a tasting, standing next to him and having producers from Alsace like fist pound him. It was like early...
Kiss the ring!
Early in the fist pounding reign when it was still like a super hip thing to do before right. like Hootie and the Blowfish kind of right. made it like, you know, what you did if you were sort of whatever. So like, you know, it was like a major... I was like, God, these guys know him and they all like Paul. And,
right. Well, I think he's helped Riesling sell in this city. Without a doubt. And he wanted to organize a trip to Alsace, a small trip with a couple people. And, you know, it was done by the Wines of Alsace, you know, trade company or, okay. or PR company, whatever the heck it is. And it was, we could organize it exactly on how we wanted it.
Oh.
So we could say, we want to go to this person, and we want to go to that person, and we want to go to this person, and we don't want to see that person, even though he does pay money for the Wines of Alsace account. We really just want to taste what we want to taste. And they were okay with it. And that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, determining your own itinerary is huge, because a lot of times you have to go to these producers you don't like on those kind of like right. junkets, and then you're like, ugh.
But that's the norm. I mean, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch, right. And that's how it is. But right. this time we were able to really be in control of it, and kudos to Paul for
to
that.
To Paul, yeah.
Yeah. And I was happy I was invited. But, I mean, we just visited everybody.
So what were some of the real highlights? I mean, what did you take back? I mean, I saw some pictures of vineyards that were pretty stunning from that trip that you took.
Yeah. It's so beautiful. And Alsace is one of those lucky regions in Europe, in France, that wasn't bombed right. during the First World War or the Second World War. So these homes are unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And they're from the 15th century.
Really? Going back.
Yeah, it's like Walt Disney World, but real.
Right.
You know, you see these homes, you're just like, damn, I can't believe people still live in here.
Right.
It's like a perfect, quaint area.
Mm-hmm. I feel that way about Japan sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, I can't believe this is so old.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, just blowing you away. When you come from America where old is 200 years and then you go somewhere else where old is 2,000 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it was eye-opening for that reason. And as well, seeing the landscape of how beautiful it is and how steep the vineyards are and how dry it is and that whole story about Alsace. And it's, you know, it's terroir. And the fact that, you know, you have these mountains called the Vosges Mountains mm-hmm. that divide Alsace in the east. And Lorraine on the west. Mm-hmm. And they're divided by, you know, the Vosges Mountains. Lorraine is the wettest part of France.
Right.
And they don't grow anything there in terms of grapes for wine. And Alsace is the driest part of France outside of Roussillon.
Yeah.
And the defining factor, the difference, is the mountains. And
right.
they're on the right side of the mountains. And that is the coolest thing. When you think about it,
yeah.
you know, with tectonic shift.
Well, they have like tons of different soil types there.
As well, yeah. I mean, there's so much different types of soil from limestone to granite to slate to volcanic soil, clay,
sand. I mean, where
else
do you see that mix you know, 100 meters, you know, really?
Yeah, I think maybe Sicily.
Yeah.
I think, something like that. But and when you taste the grapes that are grown on granite versus limestone, they're totally different.
Yeah, totally. Granite
totally different.
Speaks so differently. That's really anything.
And that was the real cool part for me. And just trying to get to know the saltiness that you taste in a Riesling from granite and the saltiness you taste from a Riesling from limestone are two different things. And that just, you know, puts your mind kind of off kilter. Yeah. You're like, what is this?
But that's
the coolest thing.
You know, that's the most exciting part is when you see a whole new landscape like that. And you're like, whoa, this has got a lot going on to it. So you brought back a wine. What do we have?
This is, this, you know, 2010 in Alsace, as I was tasting, really is a fantastic vintage.
Yeah, I was calling your name a little bit.
Yeah, like, because it's cold. It's cold. You know, it was a cold vintage.
So the acid.
So the acid's like high. Zinger. Right. You know, and when the vintage is
like the Boston I just brought out. Zinger.
Yeah. Wicked. Sorry. It's, you know, you can smell it on the nose that it's a cold vintage because the everything seems so precise. The aromas and the freshness of the wine.
Yeah, really, you can smell freshness. It's not true that you can't smell acid. You know, sometimes people are like, you can't smell acid. And you're like, really? Because I...
well, how it, I mean, how it expresses itself is freshness,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know how it's integrated, but like you can smell, you know, the fresh. DJ and, Jazzy Jeff here.
Right. And you know, I love smelling these wines because there's so many different pieces to it. You know, kind of in harmony. You know, the acid, and then there's that mineral quality, and then it's like the yellow peach. And
so everyone's got their own tasting technique. Can we get on microphone here your like swishing and swirling move? Can we get the, you know, pulling it through the palate? Can we get the, you're blowing air through it over the tongue? Oh yeah, get in there. Get in there. Hear it. Oh yeah, that sounded good.
Yeah. It's
what do you taste?
You know, I just taste this wine pulls my mind in different places. And that's what I really want. You know, it's like when you have Szechuan food, you know, and it's hot and it's kind of sweet and you don't know where it's pulling you next. And all that does, it just makes your mind move. It's like, wow, where is this taking me? And that's what I want in wine. You know, I want complexity. I want to not know where it's going.
That's a great definition of complexity, not knowing where it's going.
Yeah, and just like going with it. And that's the thing about wine. You know, you can't shoot it and then hang it on the wall and say, yeah, I conquered it. Yeah. Never.
Now I can go home.
And now I can go home and read a comic book.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
What's
on TV?
Right. It's like, take me places. I'm listening to you.
Yeah.
Where are we going?
Do you find that like the great sommeliers are great listeners? I find like if they're not listening, it's like there's no ball game.
Yeah, you're
reciting brands if you're not a listener.
You're an empty suit if you're not listening. If you're trying to own it and shoot it and put it on the wall and you know, have your badge and this and that. No.
Changing in a bottle, it's, you know, every year is different. Producers change up the style a little bit now and again.
Right.
There's a redefinition of technique that they might be using. I mean, I find as you get more and more into it, it's like, oh my.
You're like, I don't know anything.
No, it's like going through that, like, you know, in 2001 when he goes to he's the last guy and he makes it and they go to the monolith and all of a sudden all these lights are going by him and it's like I don't even, you know, we thought we were going to go visit this one color, the black monolith, and now there's a billion lights in the sky,
right?
And I can't even keep up. They're zipping by me so fast,
right, making my head spin.
That's the experience, but only that one guy made it that far, you know what I mean? Like, not everyone can see all of that. Like, the more you get into it, the more it gives you back, you know?
Yeah, it's never being, you know, always being curious. Never making it, never getting there, always on the journey, always wanting to learn more, always wanted to taste more. That's what I want to do.
So what are you hearing from this wine in particular? Here we have a Riesling Schlossberg from Domaine Weinbach in the 2010 vintage from Alsace. That's what we know from the label. What do you hear from the wine?
Well, it's just, you know, as soon as you taste it, you get the ripe fruit, you know. It's not that bone dry style, but it's also not the high residual sugar style. It's like this soft in between where you're getting some dry factors and you're also getting some really ripe factors. And always with great Riesling, the salinity in the wine. And that's just really making it a mouthful of flavor. And it's like I mentioned earlier, it's making me think. It's making me want to eat food.
Yeah, I find it like...
Yeah, it's making my mouth water.
With that kind of potency of the ripeness, but then also the acidity, that I think of that as like, a food pairing machine.
Yeah.
Like it can just go with so much.
For sure. And there's also like this crunch, like this stone crunch mm-hmm. that is just like.
Sometimes when I'm like, hey, this wine has minerality, people are like, what do you mean by that? Or like, that seems weird that there'd be rocks in a wine. How would you respond to a question like that?
Like what? Minerality or rocks?
Yeah, I mean, what,
well,
are
what is minerality?
What are we
I
talking
mean,
about?
That's a great question. What do I define it as?
Like, oh, well, I don't eat rocks, so why would I want that in my wine? Why would they want that in a wine? Maybe you have a better answer.
Well, you know, I think it's easy to make a wine that tastes like fruit.
Okay.
It's not, I mean,
it's a great beverage.
You just, right. You just, okay, it tastes like black cherries. Great. Mm-hmm. But when a wine tastes like earth or the rock that it's grown upon, that's interesting.
And how might that have happened? What do we think some of the
I think it's good
are?
It's good husbandry in the vineyards from the winemaker, number one.
So you think sometimes people might not have allowed it to speak through.
For sure. From being lazy or using pesticides or using tractors to harvest the grapes, sure.
So like the latent potential is there, and it's somebody's job
being
not
squandered.
To screw that up.
Yeah, you know, it's laziness more than anything else, and not having the desire to do something great.
So how would you set this wine that we're drinking here, this Riesling Schlossberg from Weinbach, apart from some of the more lazy examples in the history that you've tried? I mean, what do you think about this wine that kind of like, whoa?
Well, okay, number one, like, do you taste oak in this wine?
I don't.
No. Zero. And is it vinified in oak? Yep, it is. Okay, that's number one. That's like a good touch with the barrel mm-hmm. and making sure the barrel doesn't influence the wine so much that it shows when you taste it.
Got it.
Also, the acidity in the wine, you know, the wine is clean. Mm-hmm. You know, when they harvested the grapes, it still had, you know, a certain amount of acidity that they realized, okay, this is the amount we need to carry the wine from not having it be too heavy.
Got it.
And also you get the ripeness, and it's beyond ripe. I mean, this is more than just ripe. It's a little extra, and it balances well together. You know, it's a juggling act. And there's a lot of factors to this wine that are all kind of singing with each other in a chorus. And nothing is falling apart.
So that's kind of it, like multiple voices together in harmony.
Harmony,
in a chorus.
Yeah, sure.
Complex, but still not disjointed. Is that?
Yeah, and nothing is out of whack either. There's nothing showing too much. Everything is kind of, you know, they're all in the same line. Not one head is higher than the rest. Mm-hmm. It's all kind of together.
Sometimes I think of it as like a superconductor. You know how like you get a superconducting metal down to a certain temperature and then everything flows, mm-hmm. you know, but if it's not in harmony, then it doesn't go that fast anymore. Like there has to be that
message
moment.
Gets lost.
It just takes you.
Yep.
Know?
Yeah, man. I like this a lot.
So what do you find yourself pairing this wine with?
Forget about it. Anything.
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 The world is your oyster.
Okay, so you want to do something local. To Alsace, you do chacrut.
Okay, what's
right?
that?
You do sauerkraut. And sausages, and pork belly, and head cheese, and blah, 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 blah. You know, and a little bit of potato salad.
And that's a local dish.
Like a German potato salad with mustard and lard on. Awesome.
Cool, yeah, I could see that going really
awesome.
Well with this.
You want to do Asian? No problem. You know, it's got enough body to really deal with heat.
Maybe a good idea for a BYOB Chinese dinner.
No doubt. And, you know, I like that. I think this could work with spicy Chinese food as well as like the really sweet German Rieslings because it has the body. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got enough ripeness.
There's that ripe fruit.
Right. And it'll work with heat. But at the same time, it's still a little dry and the acid is so high that it can almost like extend the heat. Where a lot of times German wines, they put out the heat. This'll handle the heat and then like raise the roof.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because it's like, why did you go to have Szechuan food if you're just going to damp the fire out?
Right.
Maybe like see the broad character of this heat, like how you can play with it.
Yeah, you know? Like stoke the flame a
little.
Yeah,
make it a blue flame. It's like Cub Scouts.
Why not? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, let's do it. Yeah, let's tell some tales over the campfire.
Yeah, so I think you could do so many different things.
And you find, how are you pairing in this wine at the restaurant that you work in? What are you making happen with this wine?
Well, I mean, for Barbalud, it would work amazingly well with just the charcuterie because of the saltiness and the fattiness of it. Mm-hmm. You know, that is a perfect pairing because it has enough body and it does have the saline character. And at Sud, with Mediterranean flavors,
okay.
with the sea salt and the lemon and all the...
these are two different restaurants with two different cuisines, but you do the wine list for both.
Yeah.
And this wine is available in both restaurants.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it would work great with the Rouget, for example.
Okay.
It would work beautifully.
White fish.
Yeah. As long as it's seasoned right, mm-hmm. With some lemon and some sea salt. Awesome.
Almost like simple seasoning might be
best.
Really nice.
Yeah, yeah. So this is like the it's like the trump card in your pocket. Like you can do a lot of different things with it.
You can pull out this ace anytime.
For a lot of different things, yeah.
Somebody's sitting at home and they're thinking to themselves, Riesling, I've heard about it. I don't drink a lot. What would you say to these people who wanted to explore the category a little bit more? What are some things that they should keep in the back of their mind when they're looking for a bottle like this or a bottle that they should also kind of gateway themselves into?
Wow, that's a...
checking the category.
That is a question that is... It's kind of hard to answer. Whenever someone asks me that, like, how do I learn more about wine or where can I get great wines and where I'm going to learn about them? Mm-hmm. And I think the first step... I always say this, is finding the right shop.
Okay. Developing a relationship with somebody who knows.
Yeah. There's so many great shops, number one, in the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, world class. Mm-hmm. You go to Astor Wine and Spirits, you go to Chamber Street Wines. I mean, those guys, the people that work there are passionate and they understand wine.
Got it.
And if you just put yourselves in their hands and just ask them, hey, I want to learn about Riesling, and I've heard about German Riesling and Alsatian Riesling and Austrian Riesling, and I want to have a mixed case of all of them and all different types. Mm-hmm. Can you do that for me? I think that's the way you learn.
But say a step before that, what should they be expecting in terms of flavor set? I mean, if they are going out to buy a Riesling, what might they think they would find in the bottle if they just never had one before?
Well, there's so many different styles of Riesling. So I would say... if I could generalize, aromatics, number one. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
aromatically complex.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So like the finest white Burgundy or red Burgundy, there's real character to what's going on in the nose.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Riesling really has inherent particular aromas that aren't available in any other grape. And I think that's why a lot of people love them. It's just so... not fleeting, but there's just so much to it, and it can be made in so many different styles, and it's one of those, it could be the greatest grape in the world because for sheer amounts of styles that it pulls off and does well. You can do dry, no problem. Bone dry, no problem. You can do sparkling, you could do off dry, you could do full blast sweet, and they're all good. And that's why it's really, it's something special. So it's hard to really say what Riesling is like in general, aside from it's really aromatic and it usually has high acidity and it's very food friendly and it doesn't do well with oak and it's all right there immediately.
Well, I think that's a good start. And you have another wine here. I wonder if we might go over that a little
bit. Yeah, sure.
Different color, different place.
Yes, yes. Let me pour you first.
Let me make it very difficult for you to pour by hiding that behind the pitcher.
Yeah.
See if the true sommelier skills can do the zigzag pour.
I've done it too often.
Yeah, and you succeeded today, I'll note for the record.
I love...
ooh, that's a familiar smell.
Smell good, huh? Yeah. I always love the underdog wines. And I guess red Burgundy in general is far from an underdog wine.
As a general category, sure.
As a general category,
seems like it's on fire.
Yeah. And it is, the most expensive wines in the world for the most part. And,
But certainly there's a reason. It's not like people are throwing money away.
It's well deserved. Yeah, it's definitely well deserved. And so this wine we have here is one of those... forgotten about places in Burgundy that no one really cares about. And, the wines don't sell for much. And a lot of the times, for a good reason, because this comes from the Côte Chalonnaise in the south of Burgundy.
Okay.
And the soil is different than in the Côte d'Or. And the exposure is different than the Côte d'Or as well.
So when we think of the Côte d'Or, that's Chambol, that's Gevrey, that's Bellini. Yeah. And then this is an area that's somewhat to the south and kind of abutting that area.
And kind of heterogeneous because there's some good pieces of land and there's other garbage pieces of land. So there's some wines are good, Some are not. You know, the vintage variation is really, really, really shows in this region as well.
I think of it as heterogeneous. Sometimes generous with you, sometimes not.
Right. It's true. It's true.
So what? So which one did you pick out for us?
So this is a Mercury.
Oh, okay.
A 2009 Mercury from a producer named Pio, P-I-L-L-O-T.
Which Pio is this? Because I know there's like a billion.
It's Pios. Jean-Michel and Laurent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's someone I heretofore I had never tasted before.
Yeah, I've had Jean Pio and I've had J period Pio.
Right.
But you know, there's so many Pios. It's a
right. It's like Marco Polo.
Yeah, you really don't. Yeah,
you're calling them. Which one is it? And this, I tasted this wine for the first time. A rep brought it in for me to taste. And you know how it is, Levy, when you, you're like, okay, I'll have an appointment with you. And,
sure.
And you have this no-name Burgundy, you know, to you. You've never heard of it.
The sympathy appointment.
Right. Oh, for the most part, it was.
I haven't seen you in a while.
Right, right. I feel bad for you. You just left your job. You're trying to get, you know, you're trying to sell your portfolio now, and you're starting from zero for the most part. So let's try to find something to put on the list for you. And he gave me this wine to taste, or he poured me a glass of it, and I wasn't expecting anything. And sure enough, the wine is great.
How long did it take you to note that this was delish? Like of about a half second.
Yeah,
about
a second.
Like you're just like, from boom.
Just you're smelling, you're like, whoa.
Took you back.
Yeah. And it's great about 09. Here, Matt.
Oh, it is 09.
Yeah, it's obvious, you know? Because it's so, the nose.
You're doing
nose.
The Gary Vaynerchuk thing? You're like asking the production guy if he wants a sippy sip.
Snippy sip.
Get the camera in on here. Get the, there's no camera. Okay.
But the nose immediately.
What do you think about those jets?
It's tasty.
Yeah.
The jets are tasty.
The nose is really ripe and fresh.
So perfumey.
And like, wow. And that's 09. And 09 in the best pieces of land, like you go to Von Romani and you taste 09s. And sometimes they're just too much. Mm-hmm. They're overripe. They're flabby and they're not what you're looking for. And then you go to this.
So it's like George Foreman now, as opposed to George Foreman when he was doing.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know, he's a big man.
Or Butterbean or someone like that.
A little bit soft.
soft around the belly. And then you go to the somewhat poorer Appalachians where they don't have as great exposure to the sun.
Sure.
And you get something like this where it's perfectly ripe.
In a cool year, it could be a little under.
Right. In a cool year, it tastes like rust. And in a warm year, it sings.
So when would you think the drinking window for this wine would be? I mean, is this kind of something you'd be all over now, or would you put some of this away for a while? Really tasty, by the way. Thanks
Sorry.
For sharing.
No, of course. Sorry, I was just tasting. I mean, I think it'll improve in 5 years. Mm-hmm. But I think it's meant to be consumed for its charm, as far as I'm concerned.
So tell us a little bit about Red Burgundy. I mean, what do we have here? This is Pinot Noir.
Yeah. It's the ancestral home of Pinot Noir. It is the sine qua non of Pinot Noir. And I don't say that as the wine sine qua non.
Right, Manfred
but
Krankel.
The term sine qua non. It is the greatest place in the universe to grow that grape. And
it's become a big universe. I mean, a lot of people like Burgundy so much that they've planted a lot of Pinot Noir in other places, and doesn't always translate the same way, I think.
No, I don't think it ever translates the same way. And it's, you know, that's what's great about wine too, and reading about wine, and you really see all of the work that has been done over thousands of years by, you know, the Romans and the Greeks. And I think the most important people, the monks.
The monks.
The monks who really paid attention to the vineyards and the soil and, you know, writing down information every single year.
Yeah.
About, okay, this vineyard produced amazing wine and this one not so much.
Well, the fact that they were writing down anything, you know, we owe that to the monks too.
Right.
You know, just the development of something that passed on through the generations, whether it be in written form or vinous. You mm-hmm. know, it's mm-hmm. really pretty incredible when you think about the heritage that we got from them.
Without a doubt. And we
hold it. And art.
For sure.
You know, the history
food,
of art,
cheese.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe things would have been very, very different, you know, if it had not been that kind of monastic culture in Europe.
Yeah, it's and a lot of it is like religious fervor as well.
Right. They really bring that attention, which is the most attention you can ask for to the endeavor.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's just I feel indebted sometimes. Like I feel so fortunate to taste these wines. And because I didn't really do anything.
Yeah. It's like we grew up with the silver spoon in our mouth,
right.
Except it's a toss of dinner and it contains scrambled burgundy.
Right. And I mean, this is thousands of years of work that we can, you know, wax poetic about.
Right.
And you know, pontificate about.
But I just got out of high school and it's ready for me.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't do anything for this.
Like, yeah, I always.
2 minutes ago, I was watching like Voltron and now I'm drinking like, right, like something that took a long
secrets
time.
Of history.
Right.
You know, and it's that. And then it's also, you know, the house style you get. And I always relate it. I was really lucky in the way I grew up. And my family, they were Italian immigrants. And my grandmother was such a great cook. And, you know, the recipes that she had that we would, you know, feast upon, that the family would sit down and eat, was so special. And I think this the winemaking, it's a recipe from the family. We're really tasting, you know, the family's recipe. It's almost like we're sitting at their dinner table and tasting what they have to contribute to wine.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think it's ever come up. We know each other pretty well, and I've never heard too much about those early days. I'd love to hear more about that. I mean, what was it like sitting around the dinner table with this family?
What, in my family?
Yeah.
You know, it was, that's where I learned everything in life.
So, yeah, it's like everything I needed to learn.
I did.
At Mama's.
Yeah, it was cool because my family, we're from Philadelphia, and we had a butcher shop, and we all worked there, like my grandmother and my great aunt and my great uncle and my grandfather and my cousins and my dad, and we all worked there.
So how often did your relatives threaten to cut you with some sort of
every
sharp
night.
Knife if they, you didn't like clean your room or something?
I was always like the little punk that they would just kind of like,
we're going to make you into sausage
get out of
one
here.
Day if you don't behave.
I remember like my grandfather talking about me to my dad, overhearing them, and he would be like, that Mike, he's chicken shit. He doesn't.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just like, you
he
know,
can't hack it.
He's
like tough guy stuff.
He's soft.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was, you know.
How did you affect that?
No, I just kind of, I didn't take it to heart. But, you know, it's just growing up around your family who, you know, for more or less don't really buy into your BS. And, you know.
And the feedback loop is pretty strong.
Yeah.
Like they're quick
the
to
criticism.
Give you the opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just kind of. It made me see things, you know, beyond my what was in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's working together with your family.
There was a chain behind you too.
Yeah.
Like of history and experiences.
And you have to fall in line, but you know, it's good to have that. But then I was lucky because I broke out of it and I left. And I could have been a butcher. I could have inherited the butcher shop, but I decided, you know what, Dad, Uncle Danny, I don't want it. So I want to move to New York.
What were some of those early palate experiences like? I mean, what were you tasting?
When I was a kid, you know, we just meat, of course. I mean, my grandmother was such a great cook.
Is it true?
Oh, man. She was really amazing. And the greatest thing was we'd work all week together. And then Saturday night, she would have us all over for dinner.
Okay.
And, you know, it was pork roast and it was, you know, these special, you know, pastas she make by hand and meatballs and just like really, you know, passing the plate around.
It is.
And just, it really taught me about food, of what good food is. And, when I was younger, we never went out to eat ever.
Right. Yeah.
Because like my grandfather, he never ate at McDonald's.
Right.
Because he was like, why would I ever go there?
That? Yeah.
You know, every time we go out to eat, it's never as good as we have it at home.
Right.
So we never went out to eat.
And it seems like you've kind of swung back to that because I remember, you know, you used to be in the more business side of wine, kind of as a sales rep, but it seems like you didn't want to be apart from the pleasures of the table.
No.
It seems like you came back to that path. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. You know, you think it all comes back from my family. You know, when I graduated college, I was like, there's no way I'm working at a restaurant. I'm the first person in my family to go to college.
Oh.
I am not going to do this again.
Got it.
I'm not going to, you know, be using my hands.
Right.
So when I graduated, I was like, I'm not doing this. I don't want to work at a restaurant. Even though I've really learned to love wine.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be sweating every night.
Got it.
And ripping my suits from bending over and picking up cases.
Right.
And,
Which is very much a reality.
Right. You know, I'm not going to sweat like that because I went to college.
Right.
And then, like, you know, I worked for a big company, you know, in the wine business. You know, I thought I could have the best of both worlds, and I realized that it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And it did not please me at all.
So here you are, and you're making the connections for people at the table. But you know what I also see about you that's really pretty cool is that you're doing a lot of outreach kind of in social media, using the Twitter a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a little bit, I should say a lot. You have quite a following. It's something that people seem to look to you, to follow you. And a lot of people almost seem to be kind of imitating your style. I mean, now it's like very common for a sommelier to tell other sommeliers about like a bottle that he opened during service. And I think, I don't know, it's weird to say that you pioneered, you know, opening a bottle during service, but you certainly pioneered like kind of mentioning it at the end, like, hey, this is a great bottle that I opened tonight. And now it's like even the way you talk about it with the three adjectives, mm-hmm. I find like guys talk about it wine with three adjectives and a period, and like they can't even use the colon or a semicolon. Like they still use the period. It's like,
right.
You know, one word period. It's like that style, people responded. Mm-hmm. You know, you always tell when someone kind of imitates a style or copies a style that like it resonated.
Uh-huh.
And when it's so broad like that. How did you kind of get into not just talking to people about wine on the floor, but also kind of talking about it through computers, through the internet? What was that progression?
Well, you know, I guess it started with, you know, the big bottle. That's how I signed up for Twitter.
Okay. So something you did at Bar Blue, which you still do today, where you open up a large format bottle of wine each night, different wine.
And pour it by the glass.
And you wanted to kind of tell people what you were opening up each night in a way that didn't require like newsprint and like delivery service.
Well, I also, honestly, I wanted to sell the bottle.
You wanted people to come in for it.
Yeah.
Because if it just sits there, then.
Right. Like that's the worst. Like I hate wasting wine.
It. Especially when it's something that's really,
really
cool.
Good. Yeah. Right. You know, and you're opening up a 91 Montrachet.
Yeah.
A 6-liter bottle of 91 Montrachet.
Here's the legacy of the monks, and we're going to pour it down the drain.
Right. And and that's what it is, because it isn't proper to throw that stuff out. It's not only bad for business, but it's wrong.
Right.
You know, you have to.
It's a missed
it, you legacy. Respect wine. Yeah. Respect the sweat.
Speaking of that, I'll have another sip. Yeah.
and that was, you know, the idea. I wanted to sign up for Twitter because of that.
What? Why Twitter? I mean, you're such a presence on there now. I think for the wine community, everybody follows Mike. Everybody knows what's going on with Mike Madrigal. Mm-hmm. Why that vessel? Why not a blog? Why not Facebook? It just seemed to make sense.
Yeah, and I also have a short attention span.
Mm-hmm. Well, me too. What? Hold on, what?
But you know what I mean?
What now? What?
Like, I've tried to have a blog, and you and I have spoken about this, and I don't update it as much as I'd like to because it's hard for me to really sit still.
A lot of energy.
Yeah, for a certain amount of time. And Twitter.
If you could just hire a cameraman to follow you around, though, that would be good.
Yeah, it'd be nuts.
You need a steady camera.
Yeah, but I mean, Twitter seemed to really fit my personality.
So in and out, you could just send
in
off
and
the
out,
thing,
short attention span,
picture,
sound bite, boom. Bang, bang,
yeah.
Done.
And people responded. People came in the door as a result, I believe.
Yeah, that was really the amazing. When people were really coming in for it and seeing that happen. And you know,
you would do the funniest tweets. I remember the one where like the Beaujolais large format, and you gave it to the hot dog vendor. And you're like, it was so New York. You know? It was like, here's the dirty water hot dog man. And you were like, what did you say? Like, Sharif loves Lapierre Mags. And he was like holding the Magnum. I mean, that was got to be like one of the all-time funniest tweets of ever.
Nah, you're too kind. But, you know, it was just something. It all comes from boredom, and I don't want to do the same thing all the time.
Right.
I hate being bored. I can't sit still. It just, like, I have to come up with something else. And not so everybody can like it, just for myself.
Right.
You know?
You're not happy unless
I'm not happy unless it's, like, doing something else.
Something kind of cool.
Yeah, something's, like, clicking. Yeah. And that's it. You know, it's just being restless all the time and bored, and you know, believing in what I'm talking about, and trying to express my love for wine.
I think that comes through.
Yeah.
I mean, with the big bottle thing, I think people will really. I mean, excuse me. I think with the best bottle I opened tonight program that you do, where at the end of the night you talk about one wine that really stood out for you in the evening, you describe it. I find that what people are really responding to is that love.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's really the thing.
Thanks,
where people
man.
Are like, oh man, I also like wine. I also feel that.
Right.
Like that kind of like, I just want to share this with you kind of moment.
Yeah. And that's really what it comes from. And you know, when you and I work on the floor together, it's just like, there's a buzz. When we start opening up those great wines, it is.
The woohoo moments?
Yeah. It is the greatest
I'll
thing.
I'll tell you what.
It is the greatest thing.
I'm going to tell everyone in the studio audience right now, there is nothing better than a Mike Madrigal that's opening up a lot of bottles of wine that he likes, because he turns into like an animated like thing. You know, it's like
that
one of those
fun.
Old, remember when you grew up and they had like the cartoons that were also like live action? Like it was like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and like dudes would like go into the cartoon world. You don't remember? Like he would go on one side of the frame and you'd be like
different world.
A regular guy, and then the other side you're like a cartoon world. Dude, you like explode into like the most animated guy of all time. It's wonderful.
I love it too.
It's actually irreplaceable. Actually, that's the great experience, is seeing how excited you get.
Well, you know, it just, and that's why I feel so happy, because I found it. This is what I love. I know it. That's it. That's what I want to do. I want to be around wine. I want to do stuff with wine for my whole entire life.
Yeah.
You know, I love music too, but wine is just, it's everything that I've ever wanted to make as a career and have as a hobby and talk about with friends and have with my family and have every day. I mean, Jesus, how lucky are we?
And we get to consume it. I mean, it becomes a part of us.
Yeah.
You know, in a way with music, I don't know, it becomes as personal. Like we certainly listen to it. We certainly take it in. It affects
right.
our mood. Maybe in a certain way, like wine does, affects our mood. But like it, I don't think of us as consuming it the same way. Do you?
No, I know what you mean. Like music is definitely, I agree, is much more personal, and wine is communal, and that's like the celebration. It's like going to church when everybody's there and you share, and that's why wine is great, because we're all sharing it. And if you're down, you're buzzing, and we buzz off each other.
So it actually is kind of like. With that viewpoint in mind, it's kind of like it was written that you would discover the big bottle program. You know what I mean? It's like the part that jazzes you is the part where you share it with other people.
Oh, yeah.
And then
that's the best part.
You would get more jazzed if you shared it with more people.
Yes.
And, you know, you are the apostle of big bottles. You can kind of see that connection there.
Right.
Of someone who's like, well, yeah, this is fun. Let's make it more fun by having more.
More you know people I mean? Having it, right. But because, you know, it's true. And if you ever have a great bottle of wine by yourself, it's not that great.
It's a lonely experience.
It is very, very lonely. It's not fun.
I don't like to drink wine at home.
Mm-hmm. Does your wife doesn't drink it with you?
Well, I mean, before I got married, I should say.
Uh-huh.
Now we actually have a problem keeping wine at home. But back in the day, I would find that the same wine tasted so much better at work. I mean, part of it was the good glasses and, you know, the right atmosphere and everything.
Right.
But I would go home and I would open up a bottle of Gigandet or whatever, and it just, you know, you're sitting there on your, like, beat up old couch and you're drinking. It just doesn't feel like a special thing.
Yep.
You know, but you would go to this place and there would be this atmosphere, or I don't know. I think it's also the respect that people bring to wine in those places.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, it's just my house, so I have no real. There's no.
Yeah, yeah.
I found that I enjoyed to drink the wine so much more in the communal setting.
It's really the truth. It's not as fun if you're by yourself.
And I think part of it is just like, it's not even talking about it so much as that's like the shared recognition of smiling.
Yeah.
You know, being like, oh.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, and you know, somebody else sees that and responds in kind.
It's contagious, yeah.
And there is a level, I mean, we certainly see it so much where people are kind of asking for affirmation with their wine taste, and where people
guests.
Mm-hmm. But there seems to be that human desire where you want to share the love with somebody else, and like it's not really fulfilled until someone else says, yeah, I dig that too.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes that's the tricky part of services. You have to remember that sometimes people are looking for a shared smile, you know, more than anything else, more than sometimes the beverage.
Right.
You know,
they want affirmation more than anything.
And we kind of look down on it, but then I realize how much I want that same affirmation, you know, in the stories that I tell. I'm like, oh, yeah, it wasn't fun when I was just there by myself. I mean, it was, you know, could have been 1900 Margot. But you know, when you can't share it with somebody who also likes, and I find that with a lot of collectors. I mean, they have tons of wine. Why do they go out in public? They go out in public because they want to talk to somebody about how they could have drunk that bottle at home, but they wanted to be around others and have that shared recognition of how special it is.
It's a human need, I think. It's a human need to be around others and to share experience. And I mentioned communion, and it is communion. It's like church. You know, it's like you're with someone and you're singing. You're singing the psalm. You're celebrating together, and that's what is part of humanity. And wine allows us to do it and really have fun with it, and it's great, and it's holy.
So we talked a lot about things that you really enjoy about the wine business. Are there certain things you're like, God, I wish the wine business would change a little bit? Because I've often seen that the wine business can change pretty dramatically, like from what, say, used to be popular 10 years ago, what's popular now. Have you seen times where it's been like, boy, I didn't used to enjoy that, now it seems so much better? Or have you had that desire where you're like, oh man, I wish this part of the business would go away because that's my least favorite part of the business?
You know, I don't know. I never really think about it like that. All the little issues that come with working in this business, for me, are little. And what the upside is of working in this business far outweighs.
Sure. So it all gets swept away in the wash.
It really does. It really does. You know, and I'm here so much, but I don't even notice it. Super interesting people who come into these restaurants, and it really blows my mind who we get to talk to and who we relate with, and then who becomes your friend. I mean, in New York City,
right,
at these restaurants on the Upper West Side.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing.
It blows my mind. Yeah. You know, from being a kid who's like used to cut chicken breast for people, and now I'm hanging out and talking with the guy who used to run the New York Times.
Right.
You know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And talking to those guys, you probably feel the same way. There's like a common thread of spirit, you know, of life, that you love life. You're curious.
Well, they were looking for something like we look for something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's there as well. And when you see it, you know it. And there's a lot of guests. And maybe it's just the neighborhood or being New York City that have that. Mm-hmm. And boy, that jazzes the hell out of me.
Yeah, I find that like the change of going to a different city isn't necessarily the amenities. It's not like they don't have taxis or they don't have good restaurants. It's that.
It's the people.
The energy.
Yeah.
Like there's a vibe that changes. And you're like, oh, who turned down the volume?
Right.
You know? And everything else is cool. Like sometimes it's more beautiful.
Right. You have,
like,
you have a bigger house.
Yeah.
Right. You make more money.
Yeah, everyone's nice.
Right.
And like the museums are great. And you know, it's not the specifics. It's the vibe is different. And people aren't moving at the same pace.
No
and
doubt.
There's that level of curiosity or drive doesn't seem to be the same. I mean, it's kind of hard to replace. Once you get used to it and you almost take it for granted, when you go and you find it's not there, you're kind of like, huh.
Right, and you forget about it.
I mean, actually, and the biggest change is Italy, because you go and you completely go into the Italian vibe, which is wonderful and magical in its own way. Mm-hmm. But it's so different that, you know, it's hard to have the three-hour lunch, because you're like, wait, where's the deadline? Wait, where's the guy that's going to need something right now?
Right.
Stat that I have to get on.
Right. And that's what's great, the push to improve, to you know, towards more goals. And New York, just by being New York, is that invisible hand that pushes you.
Yeah, it keeps you going.
It's
otherwise
like no other place.
Out.
Yeah.
So what do you see happening in New York right now? I mean, in terms of the restaurant scene, wine scene, what are some of the trends that you've noticed or some of the places open up that you're excited about?
Well, I think New York is always changing and evolving and doing something different. And you know, someone's always coming up thinking, what's next? What do I have to do next? Let's try this. Let's try that. There's endless experimentation in this town, and that's what makes it New York City. And I think, you know, some of the trends that I see in terms of wine are great.
Mm-hmm. What would be an example?
Muscat A. I always say that. Yeah. It's like, it is accepted.
It's like Diana Ross. I'm coming.
Yeah. It's in the fabric of restaurants.
Remember
now.
When it wasn't?
Yeah.
Remember when it was like poo-pooed as
like cheap, yeah, cheap, you
why
know,
are you trying
horse
to push
urine.
That on me?
Yeah.
And it was like the magic was always there and we just weren't. We weren't recognizing it as a country.
No,
a while,
definitely not.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, for a wine to express where it comes from so clearly and to be priced so low,
right?
There's no other wine in the world that you get that.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
There's nothing like that where you're like you smell it, you're like, oh, that's Muscat A. Mm.
Yeah, the saline crushed,
and it's delicious,
crushed shells,
and it's $9.
Right?
Yeah, and you're like, geez. The God bless.
Sometimes you give them 10 just because you feel like, yeah.
You give a tip.
Come on, take a 10.
But I love that. I love seeing Muscat A everywhere because, you know, in the summertime, and I'm sure
yeah,
you agree, that's all you want to drink.
The weather gets warmer.
Yeah. You want to eat oysters and drink Muscat A, and you want to have crudo and drink Muscat A. And that's just the way it goes.
Special gift, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. And that's like even if you had the most expensive dish with the most expensive truffle, a lot of times it won't be as good as the oyster and Muscat A.
Do you find that recognition has kind of come to the fore in how people dine?
Like yeah, oh, definitely.
That like putting great next to great isn't necessarily a great experience. That yeah. You could have like the most wonderful, exquisite fish and you could have the most wonderful, exquisite, full-bodied red wine and maybe that experience together wouldn't be so lovely.
Yes.
But even though they were lauded in their own senses and their own fields as being wonderful, wonderful, do you think that people are moving away from what's great to what's interesting or what works well
yes.
together?
No doubt. Because people are evolving. This country is evolving in food intelligence. And it doesn't have to, I mean, like in the 70s and 80s, it was all like, you know, lobster Thermidor and Puy Fuisse and,
right.
You know, all of that really luxurious, you know, if you're not having this, you're a peasant. And if you eat roast chicken, I mean, that's what they eat on the farm.
Right.
So it's more.
And now the hip restaurants are doing like, you
exactly,
know, roast chicken. Because
what matters now is what's good.
Yeah, what tastes
what
good.
What tastes good.
What's the flavor.
Trust that. You know, you don't have to spend money on it.
Well, it's like how they used to talk about the butcher's cut. You know, this is what he takes home to his family.
Right.
Because he knows it's not that expensive, but ooh, so tasty.
Well, that's what we used to do. I mean, we never ate filet mignon or strip steaks at home, ever. We always had like the sirloin.
I didn't either, but my mom was macrobiotic.
Okay. But we were, you
thanks,
know.
Thanks, mom.
We never had that.
Yeah, no, and I find the same kind of thing with wine. Like people are looking for that sweet spot that maybe doesn't cost $1 billion.
Yeah,
that,
sure.
You know, still
especially
delivers
the
people. Flavor. Yeah.
That's the generation that's pushing the envelope.
So just your guess, where do you think those people end up when they are older? I mean, what do you think?
Good question.
You know, what do you think is going to happen? Are we going to see like 80-year-olds being like, I knew this vintage of Muscat A when it was released and it used to only cost $9 and now it's $100?
Boy, oh boy. That
you know,
is a good question.
Get yelled at like we get yelled at now for prices of Bordeaux. Gonna be like, I remember when you could buy a case for this price.
Boy, that is a great question. I really have no clue.
Yeah,
I have no clue.
I mean, it's the future because we don't know it, right?
Right. I mean, do I think Muscat A will be as expensive as white Burgundy? No, I don't think so. I really don't. I probably would see more people buying domestic wines, and I think California and Oregon will keep improving and keep making better wines because, you know, as you probably think as well, the pendulum is shifting.
Shifting back.
It's shifting back to, you know, the
layered,
land and right, and how and picking the grapes at the right time. And I think that will only reinforce the seriousness of California and Oregon as great wine regions.
But I mean, I think we all know that wine kind of draws you in and you don't necessarily know at the beginning how much you're going to like it at
yeah.
the end with your first experiences as wine. I mean, we've all had that first experience where like, it's sour.
Yeah.
And then later you're like, oh my God.
Right.
You know,
right.
Flash forward 15 years
right.
and you're like, oh my God.
Right.
This is the thing. But then, you know, when you first started, you're like, I don't know, man.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how do people know if they have an inclination for this business or not? What would you say to the young sommelier who's like, or just young waiter who's like, I don't know. I mean, do I love it enough? I mean, what would you say to that guy?
Well, you need to be curious. You know, you need to ask questions. You know, nothing gets revealed immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's life. You have to work at it. You know, but if you see a kind of a shimmer, among, you know, what you're doing, follow that, you know, or have a mentor, or have someone that you trust and someone that you look up to, and, you know, ask them questions, and, you know, just try. That's how you figure it out. You need to really push. You can't just let it come to you.
Do you see sometimes, I think sometimes people think of like the restaurant business as like the island that they're in, where really it's like you're an island with called Manhattan, and there's all these relationships, and everyone kind of helps each other out, and there's, you know, pretty tight-knit community. You know, everybody works at their own little restaurant and doesn't see each other every day. Do you find that that kind of plays a role in some of how you approach the scene?
Who, me particularly?
Yeah.
As an island or yeah. as a community?
Yeah. Do you see it as a community? Do you think, basically I'm asking, like, for a young sommelier, should he think to himself, like, I need to forge relationships that are strong with these other people around town? Or
I don't know. I mean, I guess so. I never thought of it that way, to be honest with you. I can only speak about what I've done. And I like to be around people that I like.
Yeah.
And that's
it. So who are some of those people?
You.
In town? Well, I mean.
Of course.
If you would get your hand off my knee now, that would make me a lot more comfortable. But no, seriously.
Like a guy like Aldo Sam?
Yeah. He's,
like, what a stud. I love that guy.
He brings the real.
He's
the non-spoof.
Yeah. He is the real deal. A good soul. Who else? You know, Ashley Santoro from.
Sure.
Yeah. From Casamono.
Sure.
She's great. Pascaline, she's great.
She's a lot of fun.
Yeah, people who love what they do, and people who, you know, they're just it's all up front, you know, and they like wine, and they're working because they enjoy it, and that's that, and that's the kind of people you should surround yourself with.
Do you see that as kind of more of a common theme with sommeliers today? I feel like the stereotype, whether it's true or not, is like, oh, this guy's cold and removed and he's an old guy and he's making fun of me. And that's like the old school sommelier idea. I don't know. I've actually never met one of these people, but I read about him a lot. Right. I think it's like some kind of straw man where people are like, I know you don't like sommeliers because they're cold and mean and will, you know, ridicule you in front of your guests. Like, I read that story a lot.
Right.
But, you know, today's young sommeliers, you see it's different. You think that guy ever existed? I mean,
well, yeah, I think that's the old European, you know, the French model of sommelier.
Yeah, but I mean, have you encountered? I've never met that guy
in Europe for sure.
Oh, in Europe?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. But here, no, not really. And no, most of the sommeliers are eager and excited about their wine list that I meet here in the city and in this country. So nah, I don't think that applies anymore. And, you know, the sommelier position is a privileged position in a restaurant. And we were talking about this the other day. And, but, you know, one needs to remember, as a sommelier, the restaurant will function easier without you than without a busboy.
Yeah, I find that's like the key point that a lot of people seem to have forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, then I think every good chef knows that he needs that dishwasher to wash those dishes, because otherwise the whole train,
right.
I mean, do the experiment sometime and see what happens, you know?
Yep. And I always remember that. And, you know, that's why you help the servers on the floor, you know, you help clear tables, and you help bring dishes downstairs, and you do all that type of work, because number one, we're working towards the same goal, and we have it a little bit more easy than the others. And I try not to forget that, because that keeps me humble.
Well, I mean, also, if you help him, he can help you back. I mean,
right.
Because you can't be everywhere
at once.
It's
a community.
So if you're helping him to have more free time, then he helps you to have more free time. And I mean, I think that's what fine dining service is really about, you know?
Yeah.
It's not about
teamwork.
Like, I'll just show up whenever and help whenever I feel like doing it. You know, you got to be there for the guest need, right?
Yep. Yep.
Mike, I have a lot of respect for you. I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're super busy.
My pleasure,
it
brother.
It was always good to taste with you, and I always learn something new. Thank you very
much. Thank you, buddy. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
Mike Madrigal of Balut Suit and Bar Balut, one of the real charismatic and interesting and intelligent and well-spoken and just insightful sommeliers you can encounter in the business. And once again, thanks, Mike.
Thank you, dude.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's I-L-L, drinktothatpod.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.